Hello, and welcome back to the Neurology Exam Prep Podcast. My name is Harry Sutherland, and I will be your host today as we discuss high and low pressure headache syndromes. I'm grateful to be joined today by Dr. Christopher Gottschalk, who is a professor of neurology and the director of headache medicine at the Yale School of Medicine. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Gottschalk.
And thank you, Dr. Sutherland, for the kind invitation. I look forward to discussing this fascinating topic.
I think this is going to be a great one. Thus far at the podcast, we have discussed headache generally, the trigeminal autonomic cephalalgias, and migraine-specific therapeutics, so we hope today will be a helpful and interesting discussion today for our listeners. By far, the vast majority of what we will see in the neurology clinic with respect to headache visits are for migraine headache disorder. We do have screening tools that may raise red flags for pressure-related headaches, such as a positional component to the headache, understanding that migraine sufferers may also seek relief by laying flat, or that TAC sufferers may be restless and moving about when they have an attack. And I will also often start to wonder about pressure-related headache disorders when confronted with refractory, especially daily migraine headache types. So with this in mind, Dr. Gottschalk, when in the clinic would you say that you've become concerned that a patient has entered this world of pressure-related headache syndromes?
Well, the general answer to that is more and more over time, right? So I think on the one hand, the general landscape, the general patient features that would suggest high pressure syndromes, those have been pretty stable and consistent. Those are pretty reliable. What has changed quite dramatically in the time that I've practiced headache medicine is the frequency with which we consider low pressure syndromes. And that has grown enormously as a result of the hard work of a couple of centers around the country and around the world to identify these patients more consistently, more accurately. And it's clearly true that the clinical spectrum of symptoms, the duration of those symptoms, is far more variable than we used to think.
And do you think that's generally applicable outside of a headache subspecialty clinic? Or do you think that there's, you know, perhaps a little bit more representation within some subspecialized centers?
Well, that's a great question. No, I think it is certainly something that practitioners at any level of headache medicine, whether it's primary care, general neurology, et cetera, should at least be aware of, because some of the risk factors for the low pressure syndrome certainly, and some of the clinical features should raise that question as early as possible.
Okay. So it sounds like maybe even more so than having to rely on getting positive red flag features, that it's just something that you're entertaining routinely for your patients.
Yeah.
All right. So thanks for this primer on when to consider the pressure-related headaches, turning specifically to high pressure headaches first, or intracranial hypertension, whether idiopathic or not. What would be the clinical presentation that you would anticipate such a patient having?
So most of the time that comes up when you have patients with a chronic daily headache or something close to it, who also would endorse tinnitus of some kind, pulsatile or otherwise, some of whom may also endorse some dual operation or blurring or something like that. And it's true that we would more often consider that based on their demographic profile. So patients who are significantly obese, more often in female, and particularly if we think there's a likely comorbidity with sleep apnea, which is itself a risk factor.
Okay. So to recap, risk factors for such headaches, there may be that positional component, possibly worse in the morning.
So that one, let me take that one off the list. So I will say that this often comes up in this context that people will talk about supine headache worse or AM headache, but I've looked through the literature about this and it actually doesn't appear anywhere. So for example, the IIH treatment trial of about 10 years ago, that was not even on the radar of features that were considered or discussed in their publications about headache features in response to treatment. So I think that's more just one of those intuitive notions that has been carried forward, but it's not part of any of the diagnostic criteria. It's not part of what's been published about the typical profile of these patients, as opposed to the positional features of low pressure headache syndromes. So that one's probably not worth keeping on.
All right. That's fun. I always love learning, and especially when intuitive principles are being challenged. And then maybe just to make sure I'm on the same page as you for transient visual obscurations, what are some of the more typical descriptions you hear of these?
So when they're present, they are pretty much of the classic type, that a significant Valsalva, sneezing, coughing, straining on the can, even standing up quickly, can induce a brief blackening or browning of vision. Not every patient will recognize, distinguish between a scotoma and just loss of vision more generically. I was surprised to learn recently, though, like you, that from experienced neuro-ophthalmologists in this area, that having a history of TVOs is not a higher predictor of visual loss, which I had always assumed it was. So it's useful in diagnosis or just confirming the type of patient you're seeing, but it doesn't actually raise any red flags in terms of urgency of treatment.
Wow, that's also really cool and interesting to know. Since you mentioned risk of visual loss, transitioning to the physical exam, what sort of physical exam findings might we look for and what findings might we be more concerned about on our exam?
So the only one that I think really stands out is a good fundoscopic examination. And that is, for your typical bedside opto exam by a neurologist, that's a good screening tool. But I would encourage any clinician who's considering this diagnosis to also make a referral to a neuro-ophthalmologist, because the tools they have available, OCT, et cetera, means they will increase the detection of these, and they can help clarify when what you think you're seeing is really just a drusen or some other form of pseudopapilledema. It's entirely worth having a good working relationship with someone in that area.
Gotcha. Yeah, I have a good friend who has migraine-type headaches, and they have tilted optic discs, and so it's very easy to mistake that for papilledema.
Right.
And the ocular abduction palsy, is that something that you see often?
I've seen it rarely, but the few times that I have, that would be a case where I would refer that patient for imaging and even LP on an urgent basis. So send them to the ED or something like it.
Okay. All right. So supposing somebody with this presentation walks into the clinic and we want to evaluate for causes of secondary headache, using the Monroe-Kelly doctrine, we can say that intracranial pressure is related to the volumes of three different components, the brain, the blood, and the CSF. Excess brain volume, such as tumor or edema, excess blood, such as large vascular malformations or venous sinus thrombosis, or excess CSF, such as hydrocephalus, may all be evaluated with a contrast in MRI and MR venogram of the brain. So, Dr. Gottschalk, supposing we find no tumors and no venous sinus thrombosis, what are the imaging features associated with idiopathic intracranial hypertension?
So that's a question that's been fortunately subjected to some good study. There's a great publication from our colleagues Liu and DeGray and Friedman that looked at the sensitivity of imaging findings. And the helpful conclusion of that study is that you really need to have at least four of the recognized features of elevated intracranial pressure on imaging alone to pursue that further. Now, it doesn't mean that having less than that means you shouldn't, but you can pretty reliably confirm elevated ICP if you have at least four of partially empty cella, flattened ocular globes, tortuosity of the optic nerves, or increased fluid in the optic nerve sheaths. And then if possible, if you can see it, some suggestion of flattening or change in the conformation of the transverse sinuses or other evidence of transverse sinus stenosis. And that last part, I will say, transverse sinus stenosis, imaging to detect that has increased in both its utilization, but also its utility over the last decade or so. We are now routinely performing multiple scans, most often MR venography, but sometimes CTV, unclear yet whether one of those is clearly more sensitive. But stenosis as opposed to occlusion turns out to be a very common finding in this group. And having even unilateral stenosis is a good reason to consider further evaluation, because the ability to treat that now without open surgery or even without shunting has really changed our thinking about the way to manage these patients.
All right. So some of those findings, again, were the partially empty cella, the tortuous optic nerves, maybe with some increased fluid within them, flattened posterior globes. You might even be able to see the papilledema on MRI if you're not you're not confident in your fundoscopic exam, transverse sinus stenosis, and we'll talk a little bit about treatment in a little bit. Mm-hmm. Of course, MRI is not diagnostic of pancreas pressure, and we want to confirm with a lumbar puncture, which may be both diagnostic and also therapeutic. What are we looking for with respect to opening pressure, you know, which with an aside should be taken in the lateral position with legs extended? I do see that sometimes people forget to extend the legs, and sometimes people even take the pressure sitting up. But how much CSF will we typically drain, and what pressures are we looking for?
Yeah, so that last part is a murkier area, but in general, I would use as a rule of thumb that pressures of 25 or over are clearly considered abnormal, although there are also publications that show a direct relationship between BMI and CSF pressure. And so a pressure of 25 or 6 for somebody who's significantly overweight could in fact be in the normal range for that patient, but it's at least reason to continue. Whether or not some patients with pressures of 20 to 25 are also symptomatic of what turns out to be elevated pressure for them is still an area of some discussion. Some have unfortunately even proposed the category of normal pressure IIH, which I think raises all kinds of difficult ideas. But so on the one hand, pretty reliably 25 is a good rule of thumb, but it's something to consider even with pressures between 20 and 25 when other clinical features are highly suggestive. And then the thing about how much to drain and what's the target has really never been subjected to any definitive parameters. It's not a particularly useful part of the therapeutic toolbox to consider drainage as a form of treatment. So it's worth documenting how much you drain and what the closing pressure are, but it doesn't seem to be much of a predictor in terms of diagnosis or management.
Okay. If you're doing it on one of your patients, would you target a closing pressure of like 20 or a closing pressure lower, or does it seem to not really make much of a difference?
I don't do that. My interest is in what the initial pressure is.
Okay. So thanks for walking us through the diagnosis of IIH. With that diagnosis made, what are our pharmacologic treatment options?
Just one last point to make there about diagnosis. When it comes to, you know, when you would refer people for LP, keep in mind that there are at least two clinic-based studies that found that something like 20% of patients who ultimately are diagnosed with IIH didn't have papilledema. So that part about, yes, you should certainly pursue the diagnosis when you see it, but it's important to realize that it's worth considering an LP even if a patient doesn't have papilledema when other clinical features are suggestive.
Absolutely. Yeah, the papilledema, I think of as mostly further impetus to get really going on that diagnosis.
Right. Right.
Managing them.
Yeah, but those the group without papilledema is definitely out there and worth treating. So the mainstays of treatment are definitely weight loss and diuretic treatment. Acetazolamide is certainly the standard initial diuretic that's used, partly on the basis of its mechanism, which we know reduces CSF production directly, the choroid plexus. A useful alternative there is methizolamide, which is better tolerated than acetazolamide. So when sedation or paresthesias, et cetera, are a problem with the former drug, methizolamide can be a good substitute, somewhere in the 50 to 200 milligrams a day range. Some will then either supplement or substitute that with topiramate, which also has carbonic anhydrase activity, or some direct diuretic like Lasix. So I certainly have a group that are on a combination of acetazolamide, Lasix, or topiramate and some other diuretic. That's sometimes an effective combination. But again, the results of the IIH treatment trial from several years ago, multinational and multicenter study, confirmed that the most effective combination for treatment is weight loss plus something like acetazolamide. However, the really important note to make of that study is What that treatment does is preserve vision. The other clear finding of that study is that treating IIH effectively had virtually no impact on headache. So treating it this way is something that you do in order to reduce the risk of visual loss, but you also need to treat these patients for the headaches that they have.
Gotcha. And do you think that maybe the headaches they have gets that we have sensitized them to an underlying migraine headache disorder, that, you know, maybe we're helping control the pressure, preserve their vision, but they're having more migraine types because they've become more of a headachey person? Or is this all strictly pressure related?
Well, I think it's both. So I think it's exactly in the context of sensitization that I understand this. I think that the chronically elevated pressure does induce a sensitized state by stretching the receptors in the trigeminal vascular system. And when that's been present for some amount of time, we don't know how long that is, you have then entered a secondary or centrally sensitized state. And then even when you remove the initial initiating factor like elevated pressure, the system is still on overdrive. So it's that idea that removing the pressure is important for vision, but then treating the headache in order to get them out of that sensitized state is exactly the paradigm that's needed.
Okay. And since you brought up methylating or acetazolamide, what sorts of tolerability issues do you tend to run into? Is it mostly the tingling that I get with my topiramate patients, or what are you seeing?
It's a lot of tingling. It's definitely a lot more common with acetazolamide than topiramate. A correlate of that is change in taste, particularly with things like carbonated beverages, but people will talk about metallic taste or just bad taste of a lot of things. And then sedation is not a rare feature of acetazolamide. So both of those can often add up to discontinuation.
Okay. And will potassium supplementation help with paresthesias for acetazolamide as it would for topiramate?
Not that we know.
That's unfortunate. What procedural treatment options are there for IIH, and when would you pursue these rather than medication alone?
Great question. So, of course, for a long time, the standard was ventriculoperitoneal shunting. When I trained, it was still true that lumboperitoneal shunting was in use, although I have to say my experience over time was that that was almost never a good answer because the complication rates were so high, failure rates and just other complications. There was a period of time when optic nerve sheath fenestration was popular with the idea that that was at least a way of guaranteeing preserving vision, which is true. But I have found that that has fallen off quite dramatically in terms of how often it's used. I think there are relatively few neuro-ophthalmologists remaining who would do that with any frequency. But what has really changed in the last decade, certainly in the last 5 years, is the availability of transverse sinus stenting. And you know, we're fortunate enough to have a neurosurgeon in our group who does this routinely, and fortunately is, because he's a very sensible and thoughtful surgeon, he will perform manometry at his initial visit to confirm that there is a physiologically relevant stenosis with a decrease in pressure before considering stenting. I think a lot of other centers have people who are just routinely putting in stents when it seems like a good idea. And the potential for that intervention to significantly reduce pressure and symptoms and normalize the problem is great. And I'm fascinated to learn that the existence of this procedure has also become now a default option for the treatment of pulsatile tinnitus, even when elevated CSF pressure, papilledema, or headache are not present. So someone who has, in particular, unilateral pulsatile tinnitus, which can sometimes be a significantly disabling condition, may also be a candidate for that condition just on the basis of that one symptom.
All right. Fantastic. Thank you for this discussion. So we've certainly teased and talked about important lifestyle considerations, but just to explicitly state this, because it's often very easy for us to focus on medications that we can prescribe and on procedures that we can refer patients for, but weight loss is obviously a huge component of this syndrome, as well as possibly doing a medication review to make sure that they're not on vitamin A derivatives, tetracyclines, any other big categories of medications to avoid or other counseling tips you would give your patients?
So as you mentioned, tetracycline, vitamin A, and Cipro, I would add to that group that there is actually old data that indicates Cipro can itself elevate CSF pressure and in rare situations has been a clear aggravating factor in the context of IIH. And the other treatment class that may be an important potential future option is the GLP-1 inhibitors. So there's really fascinating data from Alexandra Sinclair and her group in London that has looked carefully at the IIH group and found, among other things, that the prevalence of both diabetes and significant lipid disorders is much higher in that group. And it seems to be not just related to the body mass index or weight overall, but maybe something about the metabolic profile of these patients that puts them at risk for this condition. But there is now an early phase 3 trial that suggests that the GLP-1 inhibitors were effective in both weight loss and reduction in IIH features itself. So I think we have that to look forward to in the future.
Right. These are going to get even more popular in the future,
right? Right, if they're available.
Excellent. So turning now to the low pressure headaches, what might we expect to hear from a patient with such a syndrome as this?
Yeah, so that's the evolving question, right? I can tell you that when I trained some 20-odd years ago, the first publications had come out that said, hey, guess what? Some people with clearly orthostatic headaches have evidence of diffuse meningeal enhancement on MRI, and that immediately becomes a diagnosis and a treatment target. So that was a fascinating finding. But for the next 15 years, easily, the general interpretation was this was an extremely rare condition, and you would only consider it in a relatively young patient with a new onset orthostatic headache, and then you do an MRI, and if there was meningeal enhancement on, you would go. And it's really because of the painstaking, persistent work of groups like Wouter Schwenk at the Cedars-Sinai Center, the Duke Group, and some others around the world that have said there's much more variability here than we thought. So one of the sort of clinical pearls there is that, yes, it's true that most patients with a CSF leak will have an orthostatic headache at some time. It is clearly true that that tends to taper off over time. So there may have been a period in the past when a patient with a chronic headache had a more distinctly positional orthostatic character, but that can fade with time. So the lack of it is not necessarily sufficient reason to dismiss the diagnosis. But orthostatic is clearly one of them. The other part of that is it may not be an immediate orthostatic change. So some percentage of these patients will say, yes, I get up, I feel much worse, I lie down, I feel better within minutes, great. But it is clearly true that some percentage of patients who say, well, I'm okay in the morning, but by the end of the day, I tend to get a headache. That is probably an example of somebody with a slow leak, or at least a relatively slow reaction to lower pressure, and is one example of an orthostatic headache that should be considered. The other one, surprisingly, that is not rare at all is also tinnitus. It doesn't tend to be pulsatile in the way that it is with elevated pressure, but having headache and tinnitus in and of itself is a reason to consider low pressure. It seems to be true that more often these patients will have prominent occipital and neck pain with their headache. And it's probably true that there's more frequently nausea or other GI upset features with their headache than your typical migraine patient.
All right. And since you mentioned diffuse dural enhancement, this is one of my many soapboxes that I can't resist commenting on. I think outside of the world of headache disorders, often, at least in inpatient neurological care, we tends to delay lumbar puncture until after MRI out of fear of finding diffuse pachymeningeal enhancement and wondering whether this is true enhancement versus just a sequela of the lumbar puncture. And I think that fear is overstated. There was a paper in the American Journal of Neuroradiology last year in 2022. There was also a pretty good poster at the AAN meeting in 2015, both exploring how frequently after lumbar puncture we actually see this diffuse pachymeningeal enhancement. And it's the vast minority of the time. It's about 4% in the AJNR. And I think in the AAN poster, it was maybe closer to 1% of the time. Whereas we seem to often delay lumbar puncture out of fear of having false positives for pachymeningitis, when really, if we do have a clinical concern for pachymeningitis, there are other ways to evaluate this by analyzing the fluid we get for the CSF and looking, going down that differential for smooth pachymeningitis. So just going back to our headache podcast, I promise I just wanted to make that quick plug for my argument that I think we often delay getting CSF for a fear that is overstated. Anyway, back to our discussion on pressure-related headache disorders.
I agree with that. The flip side of that discussion, however, is that what has become increasingly clear over time is that getting an LP when the consideration is for low pressure is not particularly helpful. That the pressure itself is a very poor indicator of the likelihood of a low pressure syndrome, as opposed to elevated pressure, where we have a much more well-defined marker for what we would consider elevated. So it's always exciting when somebody has a pressure of 5 or 6 in the context of what seems to be an orthostatic headache, but it is clearly true that many patients have what appears to be normal pressure and are still symptomatic of a leak.
Definitely. As far as symptoms of the leak, do people ever report to you that they get rhinorrhea with that may actually wind up being CSF? I think I've seen that only once. And this woman, when she went Valsalva, and this was in the emergency department, I could see this effectively a geyser coming out of her nose, which was quite dramatic. But how often will actually notice that they have a head, eye, ear, nose, throat kind of leak?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's another example where the perception is that that should be a reliable clinical feature and really isn't. I think far more often what people have is either chronic rhinosinusitis for some other reason, or they might have headache-related cranial autonomic features that include rhinorrhea that are simply part of their response to the situation, but is not actually rhinorrhea itself. So I have seen, like you, probably one case where that turned out to actually be a feature of their condition and a cranial CSF leak.
Gotcha. And if anyone's studying for the right exam, it's beta transferrin that you want to send on such fluid to make sure it's CSF.
Good for you.
What connective tissue disorders might we hear people having that might have a spontaneous CSF leak?
Great question. So again, what's clear is that Ehlers-Danlos syndrome itself is a potential risk factor, that the prevalence of both CSF leak and in particular dilated nerve root sleeve is much higher in that particular group. What's less clear is whether other well-known joint laxity syndromes, Marfan's, for example, are also risk factors. And further, whether there are other connective tissue genes or syndromes that haven't been identified, but may in fact also be risk factors for spinal CSF leaks, is something that's under current study.
All right. So if we do send this clinic patient to get an MRI, we could obviously see that smooth pachymeningeal enhancement. But what other associated imaging findings might we be looking for or possibly expect?
So years ago, Dr. Shavink, that I mentioned earlier from Cedars-Sinai, published in JAMA, an acronym which has proven to be quite useful, and that is what's called SEEPS. So that is some combination of subdural fluid collections, enhancement of the meninges, as you mentioned, engorgement of the venous structures, which we can talk about in a moment, pituitary hyperemia, and sagging of brain. Any combination of those makes it more likely. And then in 2020, the group from Bern published in JAMA Neurology, first author Dobrocki, fascinating study that actually tested the sensitivity of a range of MRI findings. And other than diffuse meningeal enhancement and a general impression of brain sag or subdural fluid collections, they actually found that specific measures, which you can do on any midline sagittal MRI of the brain, so looking specifically at the supraceller cistern, the mammalopontine distance, and the prepontine cistern, that those measurements can reliably give you evidence of brain sagging, occasionally even cerebellar descent or cerebellar ectopia will be a feature of that. A reminder that any neurologist certainly who is told that a patient has a so-called Chiari malformation on imaging should think twice about that diagnosis and consider that that may in fact be evidence of low CSF pressure.
Oh, wow. I'm just thinking back to that association I learned in med school of Chiari's being associated with headaches.
Exactly.
They're actually a consequence of headaches. Well, at least of the low pressure. That's really cool.
Right.
You mentioned a couple of measures. Are there any measures of the splenium? Because I know sometimes that can sag and give us the brilliantly named drooping penis sign.
Yeah, I don't know how well that's been studied. There are other, so in that Dobrocki study, they looked at some other things like the angle of the midbrain to the cella, et cetera, and found that those were less sensitive or less reliable than some of those measures I just mentioned. I don't know that that one was considered specifically, but I think it's likely true that there are others there that deserve further study that may be simple and easy to do on a routine scan.
Okay. And so thank you for the Steeps mnemonic, and I'll try to find a way to include the figure that you mentioned in the description for the podcast so our listeners can take a look later. So when confirming low pressure with lumbar puncture, what readings are we looking for? I know we teased this a little bit earlier. And also when somebody says that the LP was a quote unquote dry tap, does that just mean that they missed? Like, what does that mean?
Well, there's the problem, I think, is that sometimes that's true. They just didn't get into the space they needed to. And it's probably true that sometimes they got into the CSF space and the pressure was so low that it was difficult to obtain a sample. I think in either case, that's worth pursuing with a more definitive study. But I would say overall, I don't recommend LP in the routine evaluation of somebody where you're considering a CSF leak. I think step one is brain imaging. And if there is any suggestion of those features we just discussed, then I would pursue that with full MRI of the total spine. And it's rare in that situation that you will actually see evidence of a CSF leak, something like fluid that's anterior to the dura, et cetera. It's occasionally true. More often, you will get hints like so-called Tarlov cysts, which are really just examples of dural root sleeve ectasia. And those are certainly important considerations. But then again, once you're in the category of I'm considering CSF leak, really the most important and definitive study is a CT myelogram. And even then, what we're learning over time is that there are particular specific technical requirements of doing CT myelography that make the yield higher. And whether or not your neuroradiologist or your center can offer all of those technical variations is an important consideration in your ability to detect these cases.
All right. So let's take on hunting for that CSF leak. So occasionally there's a source that's cranial, like a medial sphenoid meningocele, but mostly they're spinal, like you mentioned. So you mentioned CT myelography. There's also the MRI spine with and without contrast. Do you usually stratify these, or what is your initial approach to trying to find a suspected CSF leak in the spine?
Great question. So yeah, I would say I routinely order MRI of the spine on the off chance that there will be a definitive finding on that imaging. But more of the time, I'm doing that because it is a requirement for pursuing a CT myelogram. So basically, your radiologist, neuroradiologist wants to know what the anatomy looks like before they go sticking needles and dye into people's spinal spaces. So it's more of a screening test that may provide some diagnostic utility, but it's mostly just a step in that permits myelography. And then myelography itself, that's where the technical refinements come in. So centers that do myelography routinely for low pressure syndromes will do things like injecting artificial CSF, which is basically saline, first in order to raise the pressure to a level where you could detect a leak. Basically, if your tank is too low and you stick a little dye in, there may not be enough of a pressure head there to even detect the leak. So that's an important refinement. Then there's the whole business about dynamic CT myelography, that being able to perform CT during the contrast administration can help to detect very fast leaks, not something that myelographers do routinely. And then performing delayed imaging, doing CT acquisitions at 4 to 8 hours after dye administration to look for slow leaks, also an important consideration. And the really big variation in technique that has become routine now in many of these centers is dynamic subtraction myelography. So being able to take serial images in the fluoroscopy suite while administering contrast to detect dural CSF venous fistulas is a very important technical refinement. And when that technique was introduced by the Sinai group about 5 years ago, their ability or their rate of detection of CSF fistulas went up from under 5% of their cases to over 40%. So the only way you will find these is by doing that technique. And the more often you do it, the more of them you will find. So that's a really important discussion to have with your local radiology providers.
Wow, that's an impressive find rate, given how often we have to employ things like blind patches.
Right.
But as somebody who doesn't think about the different origins of these various CSF leaks, maybe just to make sure I'm thinking of these properly, from what I came across, the two most common causes of CSF leak would be degenerative dural tears, which are typically thoracic and related to disc protrusions. And then these perineural cysts, where you may get dehiscence of the dura at these meningeal diverticula as the nerve roots are coming off the spine. But then more rarely, you can get these things like CSF venous fistula, or even a congenital focal absence of the dura of something called a moved nerve root.
Good for you. Yeah, I would refine that first part by saying the anterior spinal thing is not so much about disc protrusion, but actual osteophyte formation. It's calcified osteophytes that produce these sharp-edged structures that will literally wear through the dura. And that's a not rare syndrome in typically older patients, but not exclusively. And then, yes, there are variations in root sleeve anatomy, ectasias of various type, whether or not they're in connective tissue disorders, which appear to be a risk factor. And some percentage of those, in fact, have a dural venous fistula. So going back to what you mentioned, though, about the cranial thing, so I wouldn't limit the possibility of cranial meningocels to the medial sphenoid thing. Those can occur anywhere in the cranium, and much more commonly not in the midline portion. What's fascinating to me, again, is that I was really unaware of this subgroup, and more importantly, that there's an entire cohort of patients that get directly referred to ENT physicians for repair of cranial meningocels, who then develop rebound intracranial hypertension. And the interpretation of that is that these meningocels are actually things that develop because of elevated CSF pressure, that you sort of develop an off valve in your skull, CSF leaks, things normalize, your symptoms get better. And that therefore repairing these leaks in the cranium is actually recreating the initial scenario. So ENT physicians who close cranial leaks routinely put these patients on acetazolamide because they're so used to the situation. And we don't even see those patients unless they become chronic and refractory. But there's a whole pathway of treatment and referral that exists outside of the typical headache presentation that's important to know about.
Gotcha. And thank you for expanding our horizon. I think I was picking on the medial sphenoid meningocels just because I'm going into epilepsy. And so you can also get temporal meningocels causing focal epilepsy.
Right.
So now that we've pumped into the CSF leak, when would you employ an empiric, non-targeted epidural blood patch for a spontaneous CSF leak without an identified source? And what's the success rate for such an intervention?
I wish I knew the answer to that second question. And I would say that whether or not to perform empiric patches is a function of the availability of good neuroradiology for your particular practice setting. And also an important consideration is what volume of empiric patching we're talking about. So many people who are doing patch for a post-LP headache, you're typically looking at something like 10 or 15 cc's of blood, which has never actually been subjected to study and may not be adequate either. But when you're considering empiric patching for what may be a spinal CSF leak, we've moved now in this field to the level that, you know, a routine patch would be 60 to 90 cc's of blood, that you essentially are trying to fill the entire epidural space with fresh blood to cut off any potential leak that might be in the lower thoracic or even mid-thoracic area. But that's, you know, literally a shot in the dark, but it may be worth doing because there are some patients who will respond. Then you get into the complicated area that it's not rare for an initial patch, empiric or otherwise, to work and then fail. So many patients with leaks will require multiple patches before they get a lasting response. And it's also the reason that targeted patching with things like biological glue, fibrin essentially, is more and more often being performed by the people who treat these conditions, because you can identify a potential target like an osteophyte that we discussed or a venous fistula and direct your definitive therapy right to that area.
All right, cool. Are there any other interventions or advice we can offer our patients with spontaneous CSF leak and resultant low pressure headache? Thinking again back to how easy it is to recommend procedural interventions and medications, but lifestyle things as well.
So not so much lifestyle, really. There is certainly a subgroup of patients with chronic leaks who are essentially bedbound, unfortunately, and haven't had adequate responses to procedures, at least not so far. The one other set of interventions that some will utilize, like abdominal banding or theophylline prescription, with the idea that theophylline will increase CSF production at the choroid. I have very little experience with that. I think it's occasionally done basically as a bridging treatment until somebody can get to myelography and maybe sometimes helps a little, but certainly has never been the subject of any routine study.
Does aggressive oral hydration help these patients because you may plump up the CSF space, or does it hurt because there may be an increased pressure gradient so you're making the CSF leak riskier?
Great question and unknown. I don't recommend that routinely, but it's certainly worth considering. This reminds me that the other helpful consideration in terms of both diagnosis and sort of routine clinical workup is that there is something out there called the 48-hour flat test. Ian Carroll at the Stanford Headache Group, whose practice is exclusively CSF leaks, has developed this idea that you have a patient fill out basically five parameters: headache, fatigue, tinnitus, a couple of other things, nausea, at baseline, and then have them stay flat in bed for 48 hours, except to get up to the bathroom, and then rate their symptoms again at the end of that 48-hour period, and then again some 6 to 12 hours after their supine again. And if you see a clear shift or decrease in symptoms with extended period of supine position, that's a good indicator that this is the type of patient you're seeing. I think that's worth considering.
Right. We have certainly covered a lot of ground this episode. Just to summarize our discussion, we have reminded ourselves when to think about pressure-related headache syndromes, explored the clinical presentations of patients experiencing high and low pressure headaches, defined pressure cutoffs for these diagnoses, reviewed characteristic imaging findings associated with each, outlined how to hunt for CSF leaks, and discussed behavioral, pharmacologic, and surgical interventions for the treatment of these disorders. Thank you so much, Dr. Gottschalk, for sharing your time and expertise with us today. It's been a real pleasure having you on the program.
And thank you again, Dr. Sutherland, for the invitation. Always a pleasure to talk about these things.
Thank you as well to our listeners for tuning in to learn about high and low pressure headaches. My name is Harry, and I have been your host, now signing off for the Neurology Exam Prep Podcast.